Y'all made it.
What y'all think of the movie?
Mm-hmm. Told y'all, niggas.
Who else cried? Team Tears? Team Tears?
Oh, okay. Most of y'all.
I feel seen.
It's real. That's real.
Oh, all right, boy. We're going to get this discussion ongoing here with these wonderful, amazing, and honored creators.
That's right.
All right. So let's not wait any further. Lena Waithe and Miss Melina Matsoukas.
Come on through with y'all's talented ass.
Join us.
Wow.
Hey, man.
I almost had to just call my mama. I like.
Thank y'all for that. That was an amazing experience.
That was crazy.
To be on this journey together.
Y'all knew y'all was gonna fuck us up with that.
Sorry, we fucked. She wrote it. Blame her.
Woo! All right. So, you direct Queen and Slim, long time in the making. Mm-hmm. And first and foremost, what was the inspiration behind the film? And, why now? What made you want to tell the story?
It's interesting. I always sort of got to give credit to God, because it was really a God thing. I was at a party celebrating my now wife. She was being honored by the Hollywood Reporter. So I was there. Come on. You know. Which is so, you know, she always sees me when I say this, but if I didn't choose her, this film wouldn't have happened. So, or rather, she didn't choose me. I'm very grateful for that. So I'm at this party. James Frey approaches me. I know who he is. He's like, "Hey, I'm James Frey." I'm like, "I know who you are." He's like, "I got this idea for a movie that I can't write." I'm like, "Okay, what's the idea?" And he's like, "Black man. Black woman on a first date. It's not going great. Not going horribly. On the way home, they get pulled over by a cop and they kill him in self-defense." And I was like, you can't write that. And I was like, "Well, let's exchange information." I think he thought it was some Hollywood shit, but I ain't Hollywood. So I was like, "Yo, give me your email." We just like kind of went back and forth. And I was like, "I know what that movie is." So he had a different title. He had all these different things. I was like, "Nah, fuck that. Like, I'm putting all that away. I'm just going to like try to figure out what this movie is." He had a different title and everything. And so, I just started working on it and started figuring out who the characters were. And I just knew that I wanted them to represent. I wanted her to be Malcolm X and I wanted him to be Martin Luther King. And by the end of the movie, they would have swapped places. So that was sort of that's all I had. And so I was just in my room, just like writing about it, putting my shit in it. You know what I'm saying? And just like, there's so much in it, obviously, in terms of me like with the religion and like women and the whole thing. And also I just read the book Just Mercy about Bryan Stevenson, how he basically goes around and gets people off death row. And so I was like, "Oh, what if I make her a lawyer? And what if the first day, like, her client has been executed, and so she's on this date." And and that was also too the thing about how it, like, bending the world and or being just being able to exist in it. And those two different things and what those things mean. So I just kind of figured out the journey. And the biggest thing was I didn't want a cop. I didn't want there to be some sympathetic cop. I always say there's no Harvey Keitel in this film, you know, Thelma Louise. There's the cop that you keep cutting away to, or the cop and Set It Off, or you keep going to the sympathizing cop who has to bring these people to justice. I was like, I don't want to cut away to a cop. I just want to be with them. So, which was also a tough thing to do. And another big thing was I didn't want to tell you their names until they were killed, because the big thing behind that was I just kept thinking, I was like, I wouldn't know Trayvon Martin's name if he hadn't been killed. I wouldn't know Tamir Rice's name if he hadn't been killed. I wouldn't know Sandra Bland's name if she hadn't been killed. So then I was sort of playing with that, and I was like, can I do this? Can I have a movie where I don't cut away to a cop and you don't know the two protagonists' names? But I was like, I don't care. I was going to go for it. And so I just was just writing it. And it's funny because I was working on it when we filmed Thanksgiving, when we were making Thanksgiving episode with Master of None. I was writing it and I told you about it. She was probably like, "Oh, what's this?" But I was like, "Yeah, I'm working on this thing, this movie."
Yeah, she was like, "I have this movie I'm writing." I was like, "All right, girl, you send that to me when you're done." we have a really great collaborative relationship. Yeah. And I always say she's my work soul sister, but I don't like my relationships to dictate the work that I do. Right. I always like the page to dictate that and right. My passion for the project. So she finished that maybe, a year later. And I read the script and I knew I had to do it. I knew I was the one to tell that story. Like, I had been looking for something, you know, in the narrative space for a really long time. And it just was everything. Like, it's everything. It's a fantasy and it's reality. It's part documentary. It's authentic. It's political. It's, you know, causes a conversation, hopefully pushes culture forward in some ways. And it's just extremely authentic and it's just black as fuck. And
that it is.
For me, it just had all the elements that I wanted in my first film. And then as a bonus to be able to do it with my sister as her first film and be on that journey together and support each other and empower each other and bring in other artists, you know, that could be a part of that narrative. Like, it was really important for, I think, both of us, like politically who we are as filmmakers, to create something that was for us and by us.
And there was nobody else for me. I just knew, I was like, well, if Melina don't do it, I genuinely don't know what's going to happen. And the crazy thing is Daniel Kaluuya ended up reading it first. He read it before Melina because he and I had dinner, just connecting, you know, as artists. Like, no, it was not no Hollywood shit. We were just breaking bread. And I told him about it and he was like, I want to read it. And I was like, all right, it was early. It's not even, it's like a rough, it was, he read a very early draft. And he was like, okay, I want to read it. And he read it right away and emailed me. Like, I still got the email and the subject line says, I am Slim.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I got to see. I was like, well, I appreciate that. I was like, I want Melina Masukas to direct it. I was like, she hasn't read it yet. I was like, but once she reads it, I hope she says yes. And if she does, whoever Slim and Queen are, that has to be a conversation between she and I. So I said, when she reads it and agrees to do it, y'all can sit down and we'll see if that works.
And so I read it and I was like, nah, he ain't Slim. Like, you know, all I knew of Daniel was Get Out. And I was like, the character he plays in Get Out is not who Slim is, you know? And that's just a testament to his talent as an actor, because I really believe that person. And because of Lena, I sat down with him. And our 5-minute, you know, what was supposed to be a 5-minute coffee turned into a 5-hour long conversation, which by the end of it, I offered him the role and then called her like, I hope you still like him.
Because I, like,
I gave him the role. He's Slim. Nah, but he's just so real. Like I say, you know, he's like our Paul Robeson, our Denzel Washington. Like, he's so talented. Obviously, you can see from his performance. And there was nobody else I saw. And he, you know, as a black man and there's so many people of color, like, he has his own experience with police brutality. And so he could really relate to a lot of, you know, what Slim was going through. And it was really important to him, not just as an actor, but I think as a man, to be able to play that role. And
he's so deep. I mean, having conversation with him, some of the things that he and I would talk about wound up in the script. Like, one of the favorite things, like, he and I were having lunch and he was like, we were talking about, he said his dad said that black excellence is a product of our trauma. And so I was like, huh. So how do I put that into the words? And so that's what just came. I was like, he gave me that and I was like, okay, I got to figure out how to put that in. Just it fell into place when I was playing with that scene. I was working with when they were
eating at the truck.
They're eating. And then he's like, are you a good lawyer? And I was like, oh, she can say I'm an excellent lawyer. And then have him say, why do black people have to be excellent all the time? Why can't we just be ourselves? It's one of my favorite exchanges. But that came, that's straight from Daniel.
I have to say, for this being your directorial debut for a feature-length film and Lena, you writing the screenplay, y'all have to be proud of yourselves for churning out something like this, right? The first movie, this ain't no YouTube shit. No shade to YouTube. But like, but I really want to talk about, I know Devante Hines did the score.
Hey, Blood Orange.
My God, the score.
Incredible.
It's so good because there are already so many suspenseful moments in the movie where, you know, black people are ready to scream and you never know, like, what crazy fucked up twist is coming next. And then the score just adds to that intensity so much. So I definitely want to talk about that process and then how y'all decided to craft the soundtrack and to choose which artist, because that shit was bumping as well.
All right. Y'all hear that Lauren at the end?
Woo! We did. I said, is Lauren Hill releasing new music?
Yes, we got a new
soundtrack. Oh, Melina made some phone calls.
I definitely was texting. She was like, can you delete my number? But, you know, I come from music and music's really important. And I wanted the music itself to be another character in the film. And, you know, as they travel, that we could really hear the local sounds and also, you know, show our roots in black music, like from soul
to gospel, to
bounce, you know, to hip hop, obviously, and R&B.
And Luther was in the script.
Luther was in the script. Kudos to Lena. And then, like, so, I mean, a lot of it, you know, comes from me and my friends and obviously our music supervisor and sure. Music-wise, we can get into that. But then we had all these amazing, like, music choices, and then who were we going to get to score this? And, you know, Lena and I really wanted to take it back to the 90s soundtracks that we were brought up on, you know, like... Mm-hmm. Love Jones, obviously, we quote that in the beginning, and Nutty Professor soundtrack was popping.
Waiting to Exhale soundtrack was lit.
Exactly. So trying to come up with a composer that was obviously black and super talented, and who could that be? And Solange, you know, she gave me some of the music, and then we were just talking about who could compose this. Like, who can be our Quincy Jones? I had just watched Rashida Jones's documentary on her father, and to see how many pieces of art he had his hands on, and then also to see that he's classically trained, and you know, he was working in France and then working with Michael and doing, you know, all these pieces of film that we've, you know, experienced. I wanted that for us, and Solange, you know, recommended Dev, and I knew Dev because of the work they had done, and we had one conversation, and I knew he was the one. Like, he's classically trained, he can like kill it on the piano, he can kill it on the cello, you know. And then when I, like, even I had this idea to use the Far Side's Can't Keep Running Away, I had used it in the trailers, but I couldn't find a place to place it song-wise. So I was like, Dev, what if you just come up with your own interpretation? You know, and that's what you hear in the riot scene when they're having sex in the riot. And he just did his own. He just led like a stream of conscious on the piano with the Can't Keep Running Away sample looping. And then he brought in Ian Isaiah to do some vocals and interpreted it that way. And I mean, it's just a masterpiece in and of itself.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. And he really, I think he just got it, you know, like he knew he needs to do a horror film because.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
Was also important because how she wrote it. There is no B story. There's no cop chase. I need to keep that tension, you know, even as they're falling in love, that you, and obviously there's a lot of humor and all that. So I wanted you to be able to feel the chase through the music and through the tension that we had to maintain. And that was really a challenge, you know? So we did it with the music, and he really just has such a diverse, I think, talent with how, and he even created this love theme. So what you hear at the very end when he's carrying her, you know, it starts in the juke joint, like it comes up and is interpreted a couple of different ways, but he came up with all these themes. So, you know, Dev, I mean, all praise to Dev for his talent.
We went back and forth a lot, you know, about certain scenes. Like, we'd be like, oh, it's not there yet, or I don't know, and I would be away, and Melina was so patient, she would send me things and I would look at it and send me stuff, and then I would just always hit you. I'm like, yeah that's it. Or I'd be like, have little tiny thing, I'm like, maybe you should cut out here right before you go back to that. Like, it was all these things. So we're very particular, obviously. So anybody that is on our team, we always appreciate your patience. Thank you so much.
And he really created that, the whole soundtrack. He did his first pass in one weekend.
Shut up.
And I sat in the studio with him. Yeah, and we went through each cue, and I was like, yes, I love that. Let's change this. I love that. Bring this back. And then, like, you know, some scenes.
She was getting on me. She's like, did you watch this shit? Did you watch the thing? I was like, I'm in London. I'm about to watch it right now. Yeah.
Like, the end scene, he did like 10 times, and we were like in the end of the sound mix. And I'm like, can you just do it one more time? Like, one more pass. And he did. And, like, he came up with that, you know, and it was just, it came full circle, I think, in the end.
Yeah, that man's a genius.
One thing that I really, really appreciated about this film and picked up from the first time that we watched it was that in films like this, that sort of surround like the black experience as it pertains to police brutality and what it kind of means to be black on this planet, as well as just this country specifically. I feel like a lot of time in our art, like the trauma of those experiences kind of monopolizes the overall experience of the story. Whereas with this, it felt more like a love story and a thriller that has that experience as a backdrop. So I'm like, thank you. You know what I'm saying? Like, I cried because I was very sad for these characters and their experience that could happen to anyone. And not just because I'm reminded that being black is hard. Like, so writing the script and directing and doing all of this, was there like a conscious intention to like have that proportioned in a certain way, or were you just like, fuck it, I'm just gonna write what I feel?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think to me, the thing I had to remember, and I really had to go to a place in terms of the fact that I believe that black people constantly live in a constant state between freedom and captivity. Mm-hmm. I also believe that that black joy is fleeting. So I was very mindful that whenever they were joyful, there's always the captivity on their heels. Mm-hmm. And if you can even hit like the, you know, I'm very connected to the our ancestry, you know? And so even like I'm saying, like the line of, and I love Bokeem, you know, he's like, you know, cops are like slave catchers. They can smell the free black body mm-hmm. from miles away. Like, you know, I try to put that into the mouths of the characters to say that like slavery is not far away from them. Yeah. And so that was a big thing for me, but also too, is that I didn't want this to be put through the white gaze at all. So it really, it's a film that is, I believe that black people are bilingual. We have a language of our own. And so I decided to write a movie that was completely in our language.
Yeah.
And there's, it's so interesting. Like, I think we get feedback sometimes from like people, like critics, or some people see it. There's a great thing. I think there's a white person who's like, I don't know what to think of this movie. It's like, I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that to me is like such a blessing because.
Period, bro.
Because to me, when I was writing it, and it is such a very, like, is a solo experience. You know, I was in a room cooped up. But you know, when we would talk about things, you'd give me thoughts and I have to go back and like try to find it. But the real truth is that what I found is that we are in a, whenever we, and also even too, like when they're hanging out the window, you know, to me, it was like them trying to get a taste of freedom. Mm-hmm. Like, and there's this beautiful quote from a book of written by recently freed slaves. And there was a quote, I remember Don Cheadle was reading it, and it said, what is freedom if you can't put your arms around it? And that is sort of the thing I was sort of constantly repeating to myself, is like, what does freedom look like for us? And the truth is, we're always chasing it. And I also think of the thing too, that black people are always out of breath.
Right.
We can never take a complete breath. We're always running in a way. And so to me, I also wanted Queen of Sim to be a bit of a metaphor in that we are all on the run in some way. Right. It's just a matter of what we're running away from.
And then I took that visually and I was like, wow, they start in the north and they go south. And it's kind of this like reverse slave escape narrative, you know? I knew we had to start in Cleveland. I had been to Cleveland. Wow. She wrote Cleveland in because they do still have the death penalty. Wow. And you know, Queen defends people on death row. And I had been there.
We were in Cleveland.
Scouting. In the polar vortex. I was like, cold they were shit. Not happy about it. But I had scouted commercially a couple of years back. And there was this road called St. Clair in a black neighborhood. And I was like, that's exactly where we're shooting. I still had the scouting pictures in my phone. And I made us go up there. Nobody wanted to go to Cleveland. They were like, can't we just create this in New Orleans? I was like, nah, that's not authentic. So I like to make everybody's life hard, including myself. So when we were up there scouting for the movie, what was so crazy is like we scouted that road and literally in a half hour time span, six different black people were pulled over by cops in this one area. And one of them was a white Accord pulled over by this black Cleveland police car. And I was like, there's Slim right there. I have the picture. And I was like, I'm going to give him a white Accord.
She texted me and she's like, this is it.
Everything's based in real life. And also Cleveland was the last stop on the Underground Railroad before slaves would go to Canada. And so I was like, that's where our story begins, you know? And then we go to the furthest parts on the south and on the east, and that's the Keys. And that's, we created the Florida Keys, you know? So it's like our roots are weaved into each of these frames and all of their words.
We shot it in New Orleans, which is, to me, where some of the freest black people reside. And we came home for like, I don't know, we left like 4 months, something like that. It was a beat. We really, I think that also kind of like seeped into our skin, sort of being there and, you know, us having like meetings and like being frustrated eating crawfish and whatnot. It was like crazy.
Telling people about you sucking out the tail. We not doing that.
No, we need this.
Eating this boil though.
I was really, look, the cinematography is insanity. Like it's.
That's right. Pat yourself on the back. Yes, because you did that, girl. You did.
Watching it, I'm like, who knew so many stretches of road could be so breathtaking? So,
that's all Melina.
Right. What goes into finding that shot or all of those shots? Because you spend so much time just driving around.
A lot of driving around. I'm really big on scouting and I'm really big on you know, creating authentic stories and everything being real. So I like to scout and I like to drive around. Like Shiona, our costume designer, one of my best friends. Woo, killed it. But one weekend I was like, let's go find Florida. And we went to Mississippi, and like where they end up is like us on a weekend like trip because nobody else was dying to scout with us. And I was like, I'm gonna find it. Like, we haven't found it yet. So it's just about keeping on pushing, you know. And I love like Americana type photography and then that imagery and how we can show all the different parts of our country and who we are implanted in that, like, you know, how our blood like is in that soil. So even when we're like, you know, seeing the prisoners on the side of the road, like that's still really happening in Angola, you know, like these are all real choices made based from things that are happening to us.
And that was in the script, because I had seen that. Like in terms of when I'd be driving, I'd be like, I don't know, on road trip or whatever, and like I would see that in the prisoners working the land, and they were often always black and brown, and I would look at it and it always looked like modern day slavery. And so, you know, when Slim, who's so always seeing the good, he's looking at the landscape and is like, isn't this beautiful, you know? And she looks at the guys working the land and says, is it? You know what I mean? So it's always that thing. It's like we're always looking at the world through very unique eyes, because we live in a country that we built, but our ancestors built with bloody hands, but yet our blood still gets spilled by those wearing blue and they are allowed to walk free. And so again, it's sort of like, what value do you place on your own life when you see on TV that people that look like you can be killed and nothing happens?
I really feel like all of these elements come together to create really great storytelling. And if nothing else, y'all told an incredible story with this movie. And I just want to talk about this. Maybe, well, obviously y'all have seen it, but for the sake of the podcast, it's a little bit spoilery. But so we start off with like this very kind of church boy in Slim. We've got this atheist lawyer in Queen. And then throughout the movie, we see them start to change. Slim is taking shots all of a sudden when he didn't drink before, smoking weed in the backseat of this man's car. And Queen done decided that she can lead the prayer for dinner. And all this. I'm like, we thanking God for things now, sis?
And it was a good prayer. It was solid.
Right. So I just
that
really.
That took a beat to write. That took it was a very simple, short thing, but it took a little while to figure that out.
And I it's like. That is very cleverly done to show the evolution of these two people just over, like, it's just under a week. But not only do we watch them fall in love and get to know each other, but we watch them kind of let go of a little bit of their, I don't want to say extremism, but, you know, one of them is to this side, the other is to this, and they kind of meet in the middle in multiple ways. And I was telling y'all this earlier. I also really love that there are no white saviors. There are white people who do good things. But there are white people who do heinous things, just like in real life. And there are black people who do great things and help them. And ultimately, a black man is the one who sent them to their deaths. So I feel like all of that is so masterful. How much time did y'all spend together just like hammering out and ironing out and just, I know you said you finished it Friday, so you probably were like up to the last minute, but yeah, when it came to like the two of you and reviewing the movie and all that, like how deliberate were those choices throughout the film?
I mean, we didn't do anything that wasn't intentional. I feel like, you know, from when I got the script, Lena and I went back and forth maybe 3 times on drafts before we even took it out. Mm-hmm. And sold the movie together. And then, you know, I think we really trust each other's lanes. Like, I respect her so much as a writer, and, you know, that's not what I do. So like I let her really come to life with that script, and she brings it to life, and then she gives it to me like a gift, you know. And then I take that and I'm like, okay, now my time starts, you know. And now I start prepping and moving to New Orleans and all that. And I think that trust really shows. But it's been 2 years of our lives together. Yeah.
And I mean but you're right. I mean, it is a balancing act, you know.
Yeah.
I was literally like being very mindful because, you know, and like I always knew there's some things that didn't change. Like, I always knew the cop that Junior would kill would be black, because there was just something very interesting, particularly thinking about Tamir Rice and particularly thinking about Trayvon Martin. Like, as a, these young black boys. And that's also a thing that I kind of picked up on tonight that I didn't think, like, there's like a through line of like little black boys playing. They're playing outside of the trailer. They're playing at the end. You see them in the skate in the parking lot. How do they see police officers? They see them as a predator. They see them as killers. So Junior, you know, who now sees his heroes as Queen and Slim, like, oh, that's what we doing. He don't care that he black. All he see is blue. And just to swap that narrative, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, what if Tamir Rice had a real gun
and
looked at that cop and said, fuck
yeah,
you. You know what I mean? So it was sort of me like trying to figure that out. But then also too, at the very end, you know, initially, I should tell this, man, about Bradford.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Initially, it was like a white guy who rolls up on them at the end. Mm-hmm. And takes him to, you know, and it was going to be like, he was going to be like a culture vulture. He's going to be a big white guy with a FUBU shirt on. And I was like, yeah, because it was going to be my thing of like, yeah, white people who appreciate our culture, but don't appreciate our bodies, you know, this whole thing. And I was like, you know, you know, and it was, and I think it was, you know, because again, that's what you do in early drafts. It was sort of like in my head, I was in my space, like, this is what I want to do. And then Bradford Young, the amazing cinematographer, DP.
I sent it to him because I really wanted Bradford to shoot
it.
And he wasn't available at the time, but he gave us some notes. And Lena doesn't like notes from anybody but me. So I kind of like, but I like to hear what the people think.
Right.
So I kind of go through all the notes and I'm like, that's a good one. That
he was like,
back.
He was like, what if the guy that comes gets them at the end is black?
It complicates it, you know?
And like, I was like, And then the thing I thought about, because I sat with it for a bit, like we talked about it, and I had to go sit by myself and sit with it. And I thought about, like the times in my life where I have been betrayed. I ain't got finished. That's why I needed to sit with it, because we had the conversation and. Because I was like, well, how do I? Because then I said to you, I was like, well, I got to go, like, really, I got to really play, rewrite the scene and, like, play with the scene. So I was like, give me some time. I hope I didn't take too long. I don't know. But I was just like, give me some time. Because then what I realized was how, it was tough writing him, because I was like, he has to walk the line. He needs to feel like a nigga. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, and he needs to, but then also too, he has one of my favorite lines is that he's like, y'all gave us something to believe in. You know, we needed that, you know?
And I think it's a testament to, you know, what we're going through in our culture. Like we become victims of capitalism where it's just about your own individual gains, where you give up, you know, give up the community because you're just thinking about self.
Right.
And how much is that in our music and our stuff? You know, we really need to fight against it, because for me, what Queen and Slim is about is black unity, black love, and not just romantic love and bringing us together.
Right.
You know, so I really wanted to highlight the opposite of that. So we could try to tear that down.
Right. And it was, you know, and this was before, you know, Nipsey was killed by a black man, you know, and then we were, you know, like Malcolm X was killed by a black man. And so those things, I started to go like, fuck, like they don't have to kill us sometimes.
Yeah.
Because we're so in our community sometimes.
Yeah.
We'll look at each other and not see a brother. We'll look at each other and not see a sister. And I was like, so that's when I was like, oh, okay, well, let me go like, figure this out. And it's so interesting too to sit with an audience, because sometimes audiences don't know you, like, well, he, hold on, well, I don't know, like, and then also too, there's just that hope at the end too, where you're like, nah, like, not one of us, but what I do appreciate is that you have that moment, but you also have the victorious moment with the black cop that like lets them, you know what I mean, like you have that too. So it's like, I think because we had that, I'm like, okay, you got the brother with the click clack, you know.
Oh, I just want to say, I ain't trust that nigga from the beginning. Because if he was really going to help, he would answer the damn questions.
When I saw him pass,
answer the questions.
Yep.
When I saw him pass that blunt, I was like, maybe.
Yeah, the blunt.
Maybe.
The blunt.
But when he dropped him off and then he just zoom out there, I said, nah, it's over. I said, it's fucking over. He ain't going to walk him to the plane. Yeah, nah.
Well, at that point, he doing something illegal. He doing something illegal. So he, you know, he got
to deal. He was doing something illegal the whole time.
But him counting the money is heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
Heartbreaking.
Because I'm already weeping by that point. So, like, I have to take myself out of that to
get pissed. That moment always gets me, him counting it.
So, we briefly spoke about this before, but on the topic of you discussing, like, feeling like Black people are bilingual in a sense, and being that this is the first time that you got to see it with an audience, we talked about the amount of comic relief that's in the film, but I feel like a lot of it for us is just the relatability and like the Blackness of it. Like, how much of this would you say was like this was intentionally supposed to get a laugh, and how much do you feel like, oh, this is like, I didn't even expect them to laugh at this part.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of stuff y'all laughed at that I didn't expect. But no, I mean, the truth is I started in comedy. So I think most people, they don't be from Master of None or whatever it may be, but that's really where I began. But then also too, I know obviously I do The Shy, so it was like, that's obviously dramatic, but I also wanted to get to a place as a writer where I wanted to be able to, you know, shoot with my left and my right. You know what I mean? And so like, I want to be able to, like, you can't tell which way I'm going. But to me, I think I can't not have some humor in it. Like, right. But to me, like the stuff with the father and the son, you know, Chubby, you know, like that was me getting my, you know, in my bag a little bit and just kind of having fun. And, you know, and then also stuff with Uncle Earl, you know, that kind of gave me space. But shout out to Bo Keen Woodbine, who was phenomenal. So wherever I could, wherever I felt like, oh, I can play here, I did. But then sometimes there's things that just, you know, happen that sometimes audiences find like humorous, and you know, even you're like, oh, I didn't even expect that. But yeah, I'm always most comfortable when I can get a joke off. But also too, I also love poetry so much, and you know, and I think sometimes it can get a little poetic. But people kind of felt it, you know, like to me, because to me the story he tells, which is also born out of my shit. Like my wife will always say when she can't fall asleep, she'll tell me a story. She'll like, tell me a story. That's born out of me trying to come up with something interesting that she might find entertaining. And so that story was sort of like a play on us, but also a play on, you know, Sam Cooke's, you know, I was born by the river, you know, that's my mother, you know, that's the whole, that being so influenced by that song and hearing it all the time, that it sort of came out of him going to his family members and all that kind of stuff. So I also get to play in that way. Like also one of my favorite lines, like my grandmother said that through children, we are reborn, you know? And so I like that I can kind of do that, but then also I can have fun and just sort of keeping the audience on their toes a little bit.
Well, Melina, like you said, the movie's complicated, and I think that's what makes it so human and so relatable. We see all these characters who are evil and good at the same time, which is, you know, pretty much the human experience. Yeah, Uncle Earl being all over the damn place. And so anyway, I just want to say again, congratulations to the both of you, because the movie is absolutely gorgeous. So very well done.
Thank you.
I'm so proud of it. I think we have time for a couple of questions from the audience.
Oh, lit.
Before we... Yeah, I was like...
Madonna's performance?
They're in there hollering.
Who's...
Is somebody, or am I coordinating this? Oh, no. Okay, no, I'm not. Because they actually just said we don't have time.
Oh, no. Come on,
look what you did.
Well, listen, they...
Shout.
They told me we did, and then they said we... Okay.
She desperately...
Okay, right, because she is, like, standing up. We'll have one question from this lady right here. Lola. Great.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, did you ever entertain the idea of letting them get away, was the question.
To me, because that had come up, I mean, the truth is that the reason why I wanted to be respectful to the mothers who have lost their children to particularly police brutality. And now we've sort of deemed them mothers of the movement, if you will. And being from Chicago, Emmett Till, as I always say, is in my DNA in a way. Like, it's weird. It's like from a child, I know that story. And so when someone says to me, oh, why couldn't they have lived? I say, go talk to Trayvon Martin's mother and ask her. what if, why couldn't he live? She would look at you and say, I don't know. But that was not his destiny. But I am grateful to what I like to call them sacrificial lambs, so to speak, because it kicked off a movement. You know, we didn't let that Trayvon, that hit us weird. Yeah. So we put our hoodies on. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And we looked at each other. You know, but then again with Sandra Bland, that hit me. It hit me. I've been talking to Issa about it. Cause she reminded us of us. Mm-hmm. And so to me, and because of that, you know, I absolutely wish Sandra Bland would have gotten a chance to live and celebrate birthdays and have children and figure out what her purpose was on this planet. But instead, she became a symbol of the times in which we live. So, but also because of that, when I say her name, we all know it.
Yeah.
Not because of what she did or what she accomplished, but because someone took her life for being disrespectful, for chewing gum, not putting on a cigarette, not turning the radio down. So I could never flirt with it. Because it would be disrespectful to those who are no longer here, but who are here, who are living with us. And an interesting thing is, like, Nipsey Hussle would not be immortal if he didn't, if his life wasn't taken. You know, it's like now it's like, you know, he's on t-shirts, you see his face painted up everywhere.
Yeah.
Not because of his music or because of what he did, but because he died. We celebrate us in death. Not in life. So I will never, ever entertain the idea of saying, oh, but let them live. It's like Nina Simone said, it's an artist's duty to reflect the times. And unfortunately, these are the times in which we live. So thank you.
And that's like the topic of legacy and that ongoing theme of legacy and immortality within the film. And as you see at the end with this huge mural and the t-shirts, it's like honoring us and what we've gone through.
Yeah.
Excellent film.
Really
Give
is.
Them a fucking
Thank you
hand.
So much.
Give it up one more time for Lena Waithe and Melina Matsoukas, y'all.